You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
People have wrestled with moral problems for many thousands of years, and for most of that time, they've relied on reason and emotion in debating those ethical dilemmas. Now, new methods in psychology and neurology are allowing scientists and others to examine what actually happens in our brains when we think about how we should act. Back in November, I spoke to Joshua Green, a PhD in philosophy, but a professor of psychology at Harvard. He lays out the problems, the science, and what some solutions might look like in his book, Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. It was a fascinating conversation, and we are re-airing it for you on this Christmas Eve. I began by asking Joshua Green, weren't religions and philosophers discussing moral issues long before Confucius and Socrates gave us their ideas around 2,500 years ago?
We've been at this for a long time.
So has it always tended to be a debate between reason versus emotions?
Well, I think people have long recognized that emotions and reasoning both affect our judgments about things. What's new is that we're learning more specifics about how that happens. What kinds of judgments tend to be driven by emotion? What kind tend to be driven by reason? And that can change the way we think about moral problems.
But we're thinking about moral problems through science, using the tools of science to resolve some of these issues?
Right. Well, I wouldn't say resolve necessarily, but perhaps shed light. So we can use brain imaging to look at the parts of the brain that are active when people make some kinds of judgments rather than others. We can examine the judgments of people with certain kinds of neurological damage to better understand how different judgments are supported. And we can do simple behavioral experiments to look at what kinds of factors people are sensitive to or not when they make judgments.
But it makes you wonder whether philosophers have just been spinning their wheels for the past 3,000 years.
Well, I wouldn't quite say that. But I think what philosophers have been doing is relying on moral intuitions that we just experience as coming out of nowhere without understanding the cognitive factors that produce them and without understanding their deep biological history. And I think when you understand those things, it changes your view of them.
Are you advocating a change in the very methods of ethics? Has utilitarianism become outdated?
So I am advocating a change in the methods in a sense that, as I said, philosophers tend to rely on their gut reactions. Well, in this case, it seems wrong to act, and in this case, it seems right to act. And science can tell us, why do we say that? So if I can give you an example. So there was a famous dilemma posed by the philosopher Peter Singer about four decades ago. And he said, look, suppose you're walking by a pond and there's a child who's drowning in the pond. And you could wade in and save that child's life pretty easily. But if you do this, you're going to ruin your snazzy new suit. And it'll cost you $1,000 to replace it, let's say, if you're a sharp dresser, unlike me. Now, most people say you'd be a moral monster if you let this child drown simply because you're worried about your suit. Singer compares this to a different case that we all face, which is suppose you can make a donation to an international aid organization for $1,000, something a little more, something a little less, and making a donation like that has a pretty good chance of saving the life of a child, maybe several children. But we don't think you're a moral monster for spending money on luxuries that you don't really need but that are nice to have when you could instead use it to save someone's life. Now, philosophers have debated this for a long time, and most philosophers, I think, have come to the conclusion that there must be some good reason why you have an obligation to save the child who's drowning right in front of you but not the child who's across the ocean. And I think recent scientific work sheds light on that debate.
But that sounds a little more theoretical than the issues that ethicists seem to be wrestling with today, things like abortion, same-sex marriage,
right,
drone warfare, things like that.
Right. Well, actually, I think it's quite relevant. So take the case of drone warfare. Part of what's interesting about drone warfare is that you can kill people at a distance in a very impersonal way. So let me give you an example of some research that connects to that. There's a famous set of moral dilemmas known as the trolley problem, which I've studied both neuroscientifically and using low-tech methods. I'll give you a low-tech experiment. So in one version of this dilemma, the question is, can you save five people who are threatened by an oncoming trolley by pushing a big person in front of the trolley, and that person dies and gets killed, but you can save the five people? And no, you can't jump yourself, and yes, this will work. And even so, most people say that that's not okay. What's going on there? Now, most philosophers have said there's something really right about that intuition, and maybe that's true, maybe it's not. Here's an experiment. We gave people one version of this where you push the person off of this footbridge and onto the tracks. And in the version we did, about 60% of people say that it's about 30% of people say that it's okay to push
really,
the guy off the footbridge. That's about as high as you get. Depends on how you phrase it. If you make a different case where you tell other people, suppose you can hit a switch that will drop the guy through a trap door onto the tracks. Now a majority of people, about twice as many, about 60%, say that it's okay to hit the switch. Now, almost no one would say, well, if you're pushing with your hands, then it's wrong. But if you're doing it with a switch, then it's right. And so this little experiment perhaps gives us some insight into the moral psychology of, say, drone warfare, where you're harming people at a distance, where it's more like hitting a switch and less like pushing somebody with your hands.
Well, it's also like the changes in execution, mm-hmm. the way people are executed. It used to be done by somebody with an axe right on the neck.
Yeah.
And then it got more and more distant, nooses, guillotines.
That's right.
Now, injections of drugs.
Right.
But in most of the cases that we're talking about where there are ethical problems, it's also they're often framed in us versus them, mm-hmm. liberal versus conservative,
right.
West versus East. Are these the moral tribes of your title?
Yes, they are, both on a global scale and on the more domestic disputes that we see between liberals and conservatives and so on and so forth. That's exactly what I have in mind.
Is tribalism always a bad thing?
Well,
because we naturally congregated into tribes.
That's right.
Very early in human
right.
development.
So that's the fundamental tension that this book is about, that human morality really evolved to enable us to get along in groups, to turn a bunch of separate, self-interested me's into an us. And that's a very good thing for the most part. But the problem is that the same instincts that turn a bunch of me's into an us also turn those us's against other us's, that turn things into us versus them. And so the very gut reactions and emotional dispositions that allow us to coordinate to get along as a community then make us think that people in other communities are crazy or stupid or evil.
Well, I was thinking when you were talking about throwing somebody in front of the trolley
right.
of suicide bombers.
Right.
Now, suicide bombers are a real life instance,
that's
aren't
right.
they? And depending on which side you're on,
yeah.
they're acts of craziness or
right.
their acts of great bravery.
That's right. Yeah. So it's I think that is a paradigm example of strong emotional dispositions, great feelings of loyalty leading to people who are willing to kill others for their us.
Are you taking a position here on the nature versus nurture debate?
Well, I think at this point there's really only one right position, which is that it's both.
We are hardwired for tribalism, you're saying.
Well, we are wired. I wouldn't say hardwired. So the interesting thing about the human brain is that we have gut reactions, and those gut reactions are affected by our biology, but also by our cultural experience and by our individual experiences. But no matter what gut reactions we have, we can also override them. You may want that chocolate cake, but you can say, you know what, I'm not going to have it because I'd rather be thinner. And in the same way, it may be very hard for us to avoid having these kinds of tribal instincts, and I use instincts loosely to mean both biological and cultural, but that doesn't mean that we can't also step back from them.
My guest is Joshua Green. His latest book, Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. Aren't many of these issues, like gay marriage, actually resolved by default when one tribe just outnumbers the other?
Well, I'm not sure that that's true. I mean, take the case of the American Civil Rights Movement. It's not that African Americans are now a majority in the United States. It's that not only African Americans, but other third parties came to believe that the kind of oppression that they were experiencing in many parts of the United States was simply wrong. So,
but
I think
weren't they joining some kind of a tribe in this sense, in the same way that abolitionists joined a tribe?
Well, in a sense, that's right. And I think that what's really happened in recent human history is that something new has taken place, that what we really see now is the formation of a kind of global meta-tribe. So if you look at social conservatives around the world, they're all different. So American evangelical Christians have very different views from the Taliban in Afghanistan. But if you look at liberals around the world, liberals in the United States, liberals in Europe, liberals in Asia, liberals are kind of liberals wherever you go. Now, liberals, I think, are not the only meta tribe. I think libertarians are as well. There's a kind of global free market ethos as well. But I think you're right that what happened in the civil rights movement is that the traditional tribes based on ethnicity have given way to global tribes based on moral and political ideals.
Because there isn't all that much biological difference between, let's say, Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland, or Serbs and Croats, or for that matter, blue staters and red staters in this country.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I mean, we don't know. There could be, but certainly no reason to make that assumption.
Although in this country, it seems to be that some people are taking positions on the president based on racial concerns, one way or the other.
Yeah, I think that
is
that's
that
right.
Tribalism?
I think so. Yeah, I think it is. I think that's what a lot of what we're seeing in American politics now is. A certain white Christian American tribe losing its grip on political power and being very frustrated and dismayed and frankly scared about that.
Now, sociologists and others have studied divisions between groups and their different norms and moral codes for a long time. How is your scientific work adding to that investigation?
Well, I think what we're doing is getting at the psychological and biological roots of the problem. So the idea in a nutshell is that there are really two fundamentally different kinds of moral problems. One, as I said, is the basic moral problem of cooperation, of me versus us. And the psychology is suggesting that intuitively we're very good at solving that problem. So We did, for example, a laboratory experiment with my colleagues David Rand and Martin Novak, where we put people in a situation where they can cooperate. Everybody can put their money into a common pool. It gets doubled by the experimenters, and then everybody gets their share. So the cooperative thing is to put your money in. That's what maximizes the total group outcome. The selfish thing is to keep the money for yourself. You get your money plus your share of what other people put in. And an interesting psychological question is, what makes people cooperate? Is it that you have a gut instinct that says, I want my money, but then you stop and think and say, well, but I should be nice? Or is it that you have a cooperative instinct that says, I want to contribute, but then you think, wait a second, I could really get screwed over here? And what our experiment suggests is that it's the latter. That is, when we put people under time pressure, which is a way of sort of bringing out the more intuitive response, people were more cooperative. When you put people under time lax, so they have extra time to think about it, they become less cooperative. This isn't true for everybody, but it's true for the people that we tested here in the U.S.
It's been my sense that groups often start off as cooperative, and then in time, like the kibbutzim of mm-hmm. Israel, for example, or many cooperatives in this country started off with that first sense. Right. And then in time, they started breaking up and people saying, well, I'm not getting enough. I'm doing more work. I want more money.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely true. There's always a tension between cooperation and self-interest or other kinds of interest.
Now, whenever we talk about this kind of stuff, the matter of functional magnetic resonance yeah. imaging comes up.
Yeah.
People are using it to pretty much study everything. And
yeah.
I'm wondering if there isn't a certain fad involved here for fMRIs.
No, I think there undeniably is. And I think it was a necessary byproduct of the promise of the technology that here suddenly we can look inside the black box and see what the brain is doing for almost anything. And so there have been all kinds of unwarranted claims made about what you can learn from fMRI. But that doesn't mean that you can't learn anything.
Well, how would that apply here?
So I think that what I've mostly used brain imaging for is to distinguish between different kinds of cognitive processes. So going back to the trolley problem, for example, what the brain imaging results and a lot of other results using other methods suggest is that it's a gut reaction that makes you say, no, don't push the guy off the footbridge. And we see increased activity in brain regions associated with emotion when people are facing that kind of a dilemma as compared to ones that are less emotional, as we've later learned. When people say, okay, I guess it makes sense to push the guy off the footbridge to save more lives, then you see increased activity in a different part of the brain that's responsible for more controlled deliberation and the application of explicit rules in decision making.
But in all of those cases, you're asking people something on a theoretical level,
right,
which is different than the guy who has to decide whether he's going to wade into the pond to save the child. That actually
right.
is something that it's very unlikely that we're going to have to throw somebody in front of a trolley.
Right. Well, so I think
I can't imagine anybody even suggesting it
right.
when the trolley is coming.
But I think the important thing to remember about these dilemmas is that they're models for other things. So we study fruit flies to learn about human genetics, not because we care about fruit fly disease, but because they're good model organisms that can teach us something about humans. These are moral fruit flies. I've recently done some work with a student named Katie Ransohoff, not published yet, so I don't want to let too many empirical cats out of the bag, looking at doctors and people in public health. And the broad brush finding is that what people say about trolleys affects what they say about more realistic cases, including for people who make life and death decisions.
My guess is Joshua Green, the John and Ruth Hazel Associate Professor of the Social Sciences and the director of the Moral Cognition Lab at Harvard University's Department of Psychology. He has written a book called Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. It is published by the Penguin Press, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with a conversation I had in November with Joshua Green. He was here to talk about his book, Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. And we are re-airing that conversation for you on this Christmas Eve. I started the second part of our conversation by noting that in the 1970s, E.O. Wilson and other sociobiologists made strong claims about the genetic foundations of human behavior. Today, there's a debate over evolutionary psychology and evolutionary economics. And I asked Joshua Green, is your work more in that vein?
Well, I think like most researchers these days who study human behavior, that the human brain was heavily shaped by evolution. And rather than thinking of evolutionary psychology as its own discipline, I think of it as just an essential part of anyone who wants to think about how the mind works. You have to think about where it came from.
Well, brain scans will tell you about individuals, but you're talking about groups in your book. Isn't it difficult to generalize our entire species?
Oh, absolutely. And it's something you always need to be careful, you know, to what extent can you generalize from your sample?
Now, well, how big a sample do you have to get some real sense of what's going on?
Well, I think it's more of a question of how representative the sample is. I mean, if you can have a million Americans in your sample, but if Americans are different from Chinese people, it doesn't matter if you have a million or if you have 20, right? So with brain imaging, because it's very expensive, we don't have that many subjects, and they tend to be college students or at least Americans living in cities. When it comes to behavioral experiments, there are people who have used, for example, these kinds of moral dilemmas all over the world and found strikingly similar patterns. So I mentioned the footbridge case. Is it okay to push the guy off the footbridge to save five lives? The usual contrast case for that is what I'll call the switch case. The trolley's headed towards the five people, and you can hit a switch that will turn it away from the five and onto the one. And there, most people say it's okay. And as far as I know, everywhere people have checked, people at least say that it's notably worse to push the guy than it is to save five lives by hitting the switch.
Has anyone looked at what earlier philosophers might have said if they were asked that question? Immanuel Kant or Nietzsche,
right?
or John Stuart Mill?
Right. Well, it's obviously you can't go back in time, but they have descendants, and this is in a sense about the debate between those old philosophers. So you've got a lot of people who've drawn the lesson from cases like these trolley problems that morality can't just be about costs and benefits, because sometimes it's wrong to do what would produce the greater good. Yes, it would be nice to save those five lives, but it's a violation of that man's rights to push him off the footbridge. And they think you need more complicated, subtle principles that say, well, it's okay here, but not here, and it's okay there. And then you have other people, and I'm coming more from this tradition, who think we have these gut reactions, and it's good that we have these gut reactions because, at least in the case of the footbridge, it's basically a gut reaction against violence. This is something that we have perhaps biologically and certainly culturally and from our own experience learned is a bad thing. And it's good to have that gut reaction, but that doesn't necessarily mean that this hypothetical case that elicits that gut reaction should serve as a veto on the moral philosophy that says we should try to make the world as happy as possible. And that's what I argue in the book.
A recent discovery in the Asian Republic of Georgia has revealed that there was far more variation in the skulls of our ancestor Homo erectus than had been previously thought.
Right.
And that challenged some prevailing views on human evolution. How much variation do we find in humans today?
Well, in a sense, it's relative to your expectations, right? I mean, you know, if you look at the human genome, it's not that different base pair for base pair from chimpanzees. But obviously, we're quite different from chimpanzees in terms of how we think and live. So, you know, in a sense, a genetic analysis isn't going to tell you in some absolute sense how different or how similar we are. It depends on what your expectations are. But I think your best bet there is just look around and say, how different do we seem? It's, you know, what are you interested in? What kind of variation?
Well, we can't interbreed with chimpanzees,
but
we can interbreed with every kind of human, even though we look quite different. Our body shapes are quite different. Our skull shapes are quite different.
Right.
In the end, do we all wind up having pretty much the same reactions to moral dilemmas?
So I think that what we have are somewhat different and somewhat similar gut reactions to things. But it's hard. You're not going to find a society in which it's okay for people to just lie whenever they want or kill people whenever they want. And people have strong gut reactions that back that up. So some things tend to be universal. And those tend to be things about morality versus selfishness, that basic problem of me versus us or me versus other people. Where things tend to vary is in different ways of organizing a society. So are we going to be more individualistic? We all look out for ourselves and morality consists in respecting each other's autonomy and freedom. Or are we going to be more collectivist, where we all really put a lot into that common pool and are expected to expend our resources to take care of each other? And to a large extent, this is what a lot of modern political debates are about, whether it's about Obamacare or taxes and any number of other things.
Well, people often appeal to rights.
That's right.
When these discussions come up, to property, to life, to liberty.
Right.
How do rights fit into your view of moral cognition?
Right. So this is one of the more contentious ideas in the book. I think that we actually use rights as a way to rationalize our feelings, that we have strong gut feelings, and then for any feeling that we have, we can posit the existence of a right, which makes it sound like there's this abstract moral object out there, and we're not just talking about our feelings. So in the case of abortion, for example, people who are pro-choice talk about the woman's right to choose as if that just settles the issue. And people on the pro-life side say the fetus has a right to life. And I think that when you scratch beneath the surface of those objective, rational-sounding appeals to rights, what you actually find are a lot of feelings that are very hard to defend. So, for example, when liberals say a woman has the right to choose, they're not usually saying that a woman has the right to choose at 9 months of pregnancy. Okay, well then the real issue is not does a woman have a right to choose, it's what changes between month one and month nine. Now, the prevailing view from Roe v. Wade is that it's about viability outside the womb. But if you think about it, that's really not what matters to most people, I think. So take a hypothetical, if you will. Suppose there's a woman who is 9 months pregnant and she has a child who has a rare lung condition that will prevent it from breathing outside the womb. But as soon as it's born, it will be fine. Most people wouldn't say that it's okay to abort that 9-month-old fetus simply because at the moment it's not viable. So it seems like it's a proxy for something else. Well, is it the ability to feel pain? Is it some kind of consciousness? Well, we eat animals that feel pain. We eat animals that have some kind of consciousness. It's very hard to sort of give a coherent story. Not that it can't be done, but it's a lot harder than just saying, I believe in a woman's right to choose.
Well, part of the debate often has to do with other issues, such as whether the child will be born with birth defects, whether it might live in pain, or if, whether the child was the result of rape or incest.
Right.
And these wind up becoming moral decisions as well, don't they?
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, those are extra difficult and complicated cases. But we're still divided. Our moral tribes in the United States are still divided about the plain old simple case of whether a woman who just doesn't want to go through with a pregnancy can terminate that pregnancy in the first trimester. I mean, that is still the single biggest issue.
The world has made progress on issues like slavery, although there's still a lot of slavery in the world.
Right.
As women's rights, torture, they still exist as well.
Right.
But we have changed on the whole.
Yep.
Aren't those triumphs of a combination of appeals to emotion and reason?
I think that's a very apt characterization, that I think what happens is initially, you have someone who makes a bold claim that just seems wrong. So a wonderful example of this is the great founding utilitarian Jeremy Bentham, who in the 18th century penned one of the first arguments in favor of what we now call gay rights. And the reason why he was able to do it is because he wasn't trusting his gut reactions. He said, look, this seems as wrong to me as anybody. And at the time, gay sex was punishable by death. but he said, Well, I've developed this philosophy that says that what's ultimately right and wrong is about consequences, about whether this improves or makes worse the quality of life. And I just don't see how this is so terrible according to that standard, even though it feels wrong to me and everybody else. And by stepping back from his gut reactions and the gut reactions of his day, he was able to leap forward two centuries in moral time. Now we have strong feelings on both sides. We have people who defend with passion gay rights. But we only got there, I think, because it initially started with a very abstract reasoning that felt very uncomfortable even for the person who was doing it.
But to get back to what this book is about, to some degree it's about the application of science to determining these things. How much can science help us in issues like this?
So I think that what science can do is it can tell us where our gut reactions come from and give us a new perspective on them. So I don't think that science is going to tell us what's right or what's wrong. So Sam Harris, for example, wrote a book saying science can determine human values. My opinion about that book, although it's a very interesting book, is that he's really begging the question.
But he's making the argument for atheism because he's saying that so many of these moral rules come out of religion.
Well,
but people also have a sense of morality whether they believe in God or not.
Right. So he's doing a lot of things in that book to bring it back to at least my.
I'm not arguing his side.
Yeah, right. My view on this, regardless of how it compares with Sam Harris's, is that science doesn't tell you what's right or what's wrong, but science can tell you about what's going on in your own thinking. So I mentioned one example of this. Pushing with your hands versus hitting a switch, you might say to yourself, well, is that what really matters, that physical difference? And if that's what your feeling is about, then maybe I shouldn't trust it. Let me give you a more real-world example. So I talked about Peter Singer's problem with the drowning child and giving money to charity. This is a choice that we all face. With Jay Muse and I did an experiment where we made this into an actual controlled experiment. In our version, we have it so that you're in this lovely poor country. You have your little cottage up in the mountains overlooking the coast, and there's devastation along the coast due to a typhoon that's hit, and there are people who are badly in need of food and medicine, and there's sanitation problems and so on. We ask you, do you have an obligation to donate to help the people on the coast below? And in our sample, 68% of people said that you do. We ask a different group of people the same question, except now you're not there. Your friend is there, and your friend is showing you everything on his smartphone, and you see everything your friend sees, and you can help just as much by making a donation online, but you're at home far away. There, about half as many people, about 30% or so, say that you have an obligation to help. Now, so one, this tells you something about the psychology. We seem to be sensitive to mere physical distance, which is not something that we think of as being morally important. Should I help? Well, how many feet away are they, right? That's not a question we ask. The other is that it makes sense from a biological point of view. That is, if we evolved to be cooperative with people in our personal sphere, in our community, it makes sense that we have heartstrings that can be tugged, but not from very far away. And so now we have to ask ourselves, is this an important moral difference, near versus far, or is this just our biology speaking in a kind of amoral way?
But even with near, for example, somebody is panhandling on the subway,
right?
And the person looks really pathetic, and
right.
You reach into your pocket and you pull out some money.
Yeah.
The next person looks really robust, has a much nicer pair of sneakers than you ever had,
right?
And you don't give them money. Now, that person might be in as just dire straits as the other one.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, this happens both at home and abroad. That's just one example of the ways in which our gut feelings can be sensitive to things that upon reflection don't really matter. But what the important point is that what the science can do is teach us about our own thinking. And when we say, oh, is that what I'm responding to? Then it can make us say, well, maybe I shouldn't take that gut reaction so seriously.
But often when these questions are discussed in public venues, it's by religious authorities, lawyers, or politicians.
Right.
Are neuroscientists or psychologists contributing to the public discussion at all? I'm not hearing from them.
Well, I think this is very new.
And where are philosophers in all of this? Haven't they been totally sidelined in recent years?
I do think philosophers have been sidelined in recent years. And I think that part of the problem is that philosophy has modeled itself on math, essentially. In the 20th century, philosophy became a discipline that was about essentially trying to produce proofs, even though that's not what it really does. And it separated itself from the broader social sciences and life sciences, and to a large extent separated itself from public affairs and became very insular. And part of what I'm doing and what other philosophers are trying to do, and the ones you've heard of are often the ones who are in this minority along with me, people like Peter Singer and Daniel Dennett, are to bring philosophy back to the real world and to connect philosophy back to science, which is where it started. Science began as a branch of philosophy called natural philosophy.
Americans and Europeans are often accused of trying to impose their values on other people. Could your argument be seen as something similar?
I don't think that there's any way to avoid imposing someone's values on someone else. Even if we say everybody do whatever you want, you're imposing the values that say people should be able to do whatever they want no matter what the consequences, which are values some people have and values other people have. So there's no way to avoid taking a stand. There's no such thing as a neutral rule of law. What I think we can do is try to have rules, to have laws that are based on some kind of common currency, that are based on values that, to the greatest extent possible, are values that we all share. And that's part of what I argue for in the book.
Now, other people have discussed these kinds of things in different ways. We have Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, for example. We have Daniel Kahneman, who describes two modes of thought in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. How closely related is your work to his research?
I would be delighted if people thought of my research as a moral extension of Kahneman's research. That, in fact, one of the sections of my book is called Morality Fast and Slow. And my research from the beginning, from when I was an undergraduate and first started thinking about these things, was heavily influenced by the research program of Kahneman and Tversky. And I really view this as applying their ideas to the study of moral decision making.
You give examples of collective action or common resource problems like the tragedy of commons.
Right.
What's the tragedy of commons?
So the tragedy of the commons is a parable that kind of captures really every major social dilemma. It was told by an ecologist named Garrett Hardin in a famous paper from 1968. And the short version goes like this. You've got a bunch of herders that have their sheep on a common pasture, and they all ask themselves, well, should I add more animals to my individual herd? And they all say yes, because when I add an animal, that's more for me, and they're just grazing on the commons. But if everybody does what's individually rational, then there are too many animals, there's not enough grass, and everyone dies. So that's the tragedy of the commons. And what morality is really about is preserving the commons. It's about having rules, either informal or formal rules in the form of law, that force us to restrict our selfishness, to restrict our herds for the greater good. And as I said, this is what our gut reactions are good at, our point-and-shoot automatic settings. But what our gut reactions are not good at is when you have different societies that solve the tragedy of the commons in different ways, some more individualistic, some more collectivist, some rally around the Judeo-Christian God, and some rally around Allah. That's the modern problem. It's not me versus us. It's us versus them, our interests versus their interests. And that's when I think the slow thinking, what I call manual mode, is what we need if we're going to try to get along.
Joshua Green is the John and Ruth Hazel Associate Professor of Social Sciences and the Director of the Moral Cognition Lab at Harvard University's Department of Psychology. His latest book, Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them, published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.